Are vegans actually unhealthy?
Does cannabis ruin your sleep?
And why are so many men taking testosterone supplements? I'm Mitch.
And I'm Greg.
And we're the creators of the popular YouTube channel ASAP Science.
Every week on our podcast Side Note by ASAP Science, we explain the science behind a controversial subject with recent research, up-to-date studies, and ridiculous stories so you are entertained while, bam, simultaneously learning.
We're here to make science make sense.
Download Side Note by ASAP Science wherever you get your podcasts.
You might feel like you've seen this movie. That doesn't mean it's not still terrifying.
The deadly coronavirus outbreak in China is growing.
The city of Wuhan has set up stricter measures to stop the virus from spreading even further.
International restrictions are being put in place at many airports.
The death toll from the coronavirus is now up to 9, and there are 440 cases of the new viral illness.
The illness has spread as well from Wuhan out into, for example, Thailand and into Taiwan, South Korea, Japan. This morning, Hong Kong announced its first case.
The deadly coronavirus outbreak in China is growing, and that virus has now come to North America.
I'm not going to sit here and read you headlines or numbers or facts or tell you where in the world the new coronavirus has been spotted now, or tell you who has it and how many of them are dead. You just heard the news. There are plenty of outlets doing that, and they should. That's their job. What we are going to do is teach you about what happens when diseases like this emerge and start grabbing headlines, and show you what the people who do tackle this stuff for a living look for when they see and hear these news reports. Because we might see the same names and places and facts and figures, but what the experts read from that is sometimes totally opposite from what the public does. So if we are going to be scared, and look, the World Health Organization is right now in meetings to determine if this is a global health emergency. So it's okay to be scared, but let's at least be smart about it. I'm Jordan Heath Rawlings. This is The Big Story. Dr. David Fisman is an epidemiologist at the University of Toronto. He was also a part of the team at Toronto Public Health during the SARS crisis in 2003. Hi, David.
Hello. Thank you for having me.
No problem. It is my job to be kind of the voice of the audience in these situations. So my first question is just basically like, how terrified should I be?
Is not at all an acceptable answer. I think not at all is probably the most accurate answer.
It is a welcome answer.
Yeah. I mean, don't be terrified. We've seen this movie before.
Tell me about the movie. So when did we first hear about this particular virus, and what were the reports?
So it's about 3 weeks ago. This is apparently now, based on reports, we know this is the outbreak, such as it is, has probably been going on since December. The initial outbreak was in the Chinese city of Wuhan, which seems to be where most of the cases are concentrated. The initial report was of a cluster of 40 people who had pneumonia and fever, and those people had the commonality that they had all or almost all been in contact with an animal market in Wuhan, China.
Right.
In those first 40 cases, and this is important, there was one instance where in a household, somebody who'd been at the market transmitted the virus to someone else in their household. So you had 40 primary cases, and then you had a secondary case. But good on China for telling everybody and being, sorry, I don't want this to sound kind of like jerky, but like surprisingly transparent and getting this out there rapidly, Chinese virologists rapidly sequencing this new virus, showing us that it's basically a close cousin of MERS coronavirus and SARS coronavirus, which of course has Canadians sort of having nasty flashbacks.
Yes.
But It's one of them, and the family's called the beta coronaviruses. If you want to be like dorky with your friends, you can say, oh, I think this beta coronavirus outbreak in Wuhan. But so you have 40 primary cases making one secondary case. Now they're engaged in case finding. And, you know, I'm sort of looking at Twitter and facepalming a bit because people are saying, oh, my God, it was 40 cases last week and now we're up to, you know, 240 cases 2 weeks ago. Now it's 250 cases a few weeks later. Well,
right. And that's why I ask the terrifying question, right, because it does spark that emotion.
Yeah, yeah. No, for sure. And I think we're hardwired to feel that emotion.
So why are you facepalming, though?
Why am I facepalming? So we don't know the dynamics of this thing, but I'm working from analogy from the coronaviruses we do know, which is SARS and MERS. And what I'll tell you is, we've seen this movie. This is the same as last time, which is reassuring, but also potentially scary in some ways. And I guess we could sort of unpack that, mm-hmm, because I do have concerns. I'm a physician. I work part-time in a hospital. And I also was a public health officer in 2003, so have very vivid memories of SARS and what an absolute nightmare that was to get through. It's very important and consistent with this weird, it's transmissible, but it's not transmissible thing. It's very important to remember that during SARS, I think it was 12 North American cities imported cases of SARS, Toronto being one of them. Vancouver was certainly one of them, Chicago, New York, San Francisco, LA. I can't remember the others. But we were the only city in North America that dropped this fly ball, right? It's like it's an easy fly ball. This hit to 12 different baseball players and 11 of them caught it, right? And then they hit it to Toronto and it's like Toronto dropped it and it bounced all over and you sort of one of these humiliating things where you're asked to leave the field. So we had this sort of, and Toronto was sort of an epic disaster last time around with SARS, because not only did we have outbreaks, which were hospital centered, and that's also important, and we can circle back to that, hospital centered outbreaks, but we had our own little kind of, not a cover-up exactly, but people started playing fast and loose with numbers to try and make the thing go away, which meant that we were the only city on planet Earth that had a double SARS outbreak. Mm. So we had a SARS outbreak that started and was going away by April 2003, and then came roaring back in May. I think the question is, and I've talked to colleagues about this, this is our stress test. How much did we learn from SARS?
Yeah.
I think in terms of clinicians, the knowledge base is very different in terms of how respiratory viruses can sort of take you down, kill you, kill mm-hmm. your colleagues, close your ICU. Like, people get that. You say SARS, it's a shorthand for that. Infection control in hospitals is at a different level than it was in 2003, having lived experience with both. What I worry about in terms of the Toronto health ecosystem is the crowding, mm-hmm. Because that's what kicked off SARS, was dude in emergency room in Scarborough for hours and hours and hours and able to transmit to three other people during that emergency room visit, which sets up this whole chain of transmission, which results in the takedown of our healthcare system effectively and $1.1 billion in costs. So that's what I worry about, is the crowding, which we still haven't figured out. The physical plan of our hospitals is a little bit of an accident waiting to happen, I think.
Tell me what we know about this virus in particular. You mentioned it's close to the other two. What are the symptoms? What does it do? How dangerous is it?
So it seems to... And this, is, again, is always the case with emerging infectious diseases, is the more severe cases sort of have, sort of put their hand up and say, please count me.
Right.
I'm super sick. I am in the ICU with mystery pneumonia. So please test me for all viruses, including weird new fish market crazy virus. Mm-hmm. Right. So people are focused on folks who are super sick. And then the bigger the concentric circles around that, the less the severity, the less likely you are to actually identify cases. So what we probably have here is probably the tip of the iceberg. There's been some work, we all have our kind of thing that we do. There's a group at Imperial College London who have this, they've sort of added a jerry can of diesel and started up their mathematical model that takes exported cases and tries to back calculate how large the outbreak must be for you to have, this many cases in Japan, this many cases in South Korea, and so forth, based on travel plans, travel patterns, sorry. And they're saying, oh, cool, the real denominator must be about 1,700 cases. And it's like, well, okay, big city, it's a big place, big outbreak. 4,000 people die every year in Canada from influenza. So, just mm-hmm. to put those numbers in context. At any rate, be that as it may, what do we know about this thing? Well, the sequence of the virus is very similar to the sequence of SARS and MERS. SARS, bat origin. MERS, probably bat origin via camels. Okay, so this, if you had to bet, bat origin, live animal market, seafood market predominantly, but other critters being sold at this market, that's SARS again. How'd SARS get from bats to civet cats? Well, you know, there's this very sort of Catholic, lowercase c, Catholic kind of regime in some parts of China, and people eat a lot of different critters. There are a lot of live animal markets to meet that need. So what you have is creatures that normally would be widely separated by habitat or geography, suddenly cheek by jowl. And you saw this in with SARS, with civet cats being stored in, live civet cats being kept in close proximity to other animals, and presumably the bat virus getting to the civet cats that way. So I'm presuming it's going to look something like that. We know it's not that transmissible usually, because we had 40 primary cases and one secondary case.
Right.
We also know from our virologist friends that those first sequences of the first viruses that they sequenced aren't that different from each other and are much less different than you would have expected if the virus had passaged from person to person to person to person. So it's well conserved. That suggests it's a point source outbreak, right? Right. So it's like, you know, it's like diarrhea outbreak at the burger joint. You know, everybody had the nasty burger, the nasty ground beef, or the lettuce with E. coli on it, and all of a sudden you have a bunch of cases, but it's a point source. It's not person to person. So that initial outbreak looks like that. So that is reassuring. And that, again, is consistent with SARS, consistent with MERS. MERS coronavirus, occasional within family transmission. SARS, we know in Toronto, not a lot of community transmission, very focused in hospitals. And that brings you back to this idea of a reproduction number, which is what makes communicable diseases scary. And I think we talked about this with malaria.
Yeah,
I feel like you're going to get an MPH. If you keep inviting me back, we need to give you a degree, because
you probably need to charge me tuition. Yeah, more accurate.
We'll talk offline. But the reproduction numbers, this idea that communicable diseases are scary because you have primary cases making secondary cases and setting up chains of transmission.
Right.
And if a primary case creates more than one secondary cases on average, what you get is exponential growth, which scares the F out of everybody because it's scary as F.
In 2007, TV network CBS dropped 40 kids in the middle of the New Mexico desert as part of a brand new reality show. These kids would have to build their own society from scratch. And if this sounds like Lord of the Flies to you, well, it was meant to.
We were on this mission together. We were going to prove to the world that we could make a better society than adults could.
I'm Josh Gwynn, and I want to know what this wild TV experiment was really about. Split Screen, Kid Nation, a 6-part podcast from CBC. Available now.
When you just see the numbers online right now that are being announced to people who don't know much about this stuff, that's what it feels like.
Yeah, and it may or may not be. The difficulty is we don't have any sort of dates, right?
Right.
And this is going back to December. So I just don't know. I've never been to a live animal market in Wuhan, so I don't know what those markets are like. You know, is this is from other cities in China as well. So is there kind of a pool of critters that have this this virus on board, and so you have multiple introductions in multiple places? I just don't know. We do know it can be transmissible, and this is actually coming from 2-3 days ago now, in exactly the manner that SARS was transmissible, where you have this sudden cluster of 14 healthcare workers infected in a hospital in China, and not a lot of details, but we can sort of infer that that would have been an event like what happened here at Sunnybrook in Toronto, which is someone has this virus, they get really sick, they crash, they stop being able to breathe by themselves. And so you get, you know, it's one of these, this is a PTSD moments for me from residency training. Someone's crashing, they code, as the, you know, as the jargon goes, and suddenly they're surrounded by physicians, nurses, respiratory therapists who are trying to intubate them. And what happened in Toronto was you had people who were wearing personal protective items. But when you put a breathing tube down someone's throat, you can create a lot of droplets. You can effectively create an aerosol. How you make them breathe, if you bag mask, ventilate them. Sorry, this is probably TMI, but you know, if they retch and cough as you try to put the endotracheal tube into their throat, all of that can create aerosol. So, you know, we have this very non-infectious virus that in the healthcare setting can take off like crazy.
What I find really interesting just about a lot of this conversation is that a lot of the things that freak the lay people out, myself included, are the things that you can kind of see as reassuring and according to pattern.
Yeah, maybe.
At least so far, perhaps.
Yeah, you know, there's this line in the musical Hamilton where George Washington is there and Aaron Burr is going out and Alexander Hamilton is coming in. And he says, "Hamilton, do you know Burr?" And they both say simultaneously, "Yes, we keep meeting." And I feel like this, as someone who teaches communicable disease epidemiology at U of T, it's like every couple of years, there's one of these really freaky events. And then people learn about it and learn about it and learn about it. And, oh, it's a bat virus. You know, that's Ebola. That's Nipah virus, which you may or may not have heard of. It's MERS. It's SARS. It's like, oh, bats. Yes, we keep meeting. And it's not the bat's fault. I mean, human beings, you know, I mean, this is a bit of a jerky thing to say, but we're kind of an invasive species on the planet, right? Mm-hmm. We're going everywhere. We're up in every, we're up in the grills of all the other species where, you know, you're a bat hanging out in your cave and suddenly we're saying, oh, you're a foodstuff. And not only are you foodstuff, but we're going to keep you in close proximity to other creatures that you can infect with whatever pathogen wasn't bothering you. In the case of the initial Nipah outbreak, it was, you know, bulldozing of rainforest in Malaysia to build pig farms that put pigs and bats in close proximity because right. There are bats up in the canopy and the pigs are down on the ground.
Everything does come back to how we wreck the planet, but that's a whole other podcast.
Yeah.
So answer this for me. Over the next week or so, what will you be paying attention to determine kind of how seriously to take this, what steps to take next?
You know, I don't know. I don't think the next week is enough of a time horizon.
Okay.
I think with Ebola in 2015, which I and some students really started modeling during that outbreak, it had been going on since, I think, March of 2014. We started getting concerned and actually started working on it that summer because it became clear that this was exponential growth. The reason you could work on Ebola is we had multiple reports of cases at different points in time. So we could sort of, we had a cumulative case count and we could sort of back up and decompose that into how many new cases appeared at each point in time. And that's the sort of thing you would need to sort of estimate growth. I would assume that this thing has what's called a generation time of about 12 days, which is what SARS and MERS had. It's probably right. Good enough. It's, you know, it's acting like SARS and MERS. It's genetically like SARS and MERS, it's emerged like SARS and MERS, and then, you know, I don't think it's unreasonable to think, oh, well, 12-day intervals are probably the relevant time step here. So you would be concerned, I think. Now, in China, obviously, you know, they have public health professionals there, they have virologists, mm-hmm. They have folks who are working to contain this. So to some extent, growth is going to be slowed simply by those containment efforts. But if you get these giant, potentially exponential leaps in case counts at 12-day intervals, I would think, oh boy, that's not good. My bet is, and I would actually wager on this, is that we're not going to see that. I think we'll see some scary things. You know, if you think about a 14-case cluster in a hospital and the reproduction number on average, if you know about it, is 0.1. Right, you're going to get 1.4 secondary cases from that 14-case cluster, and people are going to say, oh my God, there's a chain of transmission in this hospital because we had 14 cases. Now we've got another two cases or another one case, and people are going to be upset about that and so forth because actually transmission's happening in the hospital. That's actually okay. If each old case makes less than one new case, this goes away by itself. What we had with SARS in hospitals in Toronto was each old case in hospitals, not in the community, was making three new cases before it went away.
Right.
And, you know, the reproduction numbers can be awfully close to one and still create scary stuff. Ebola was 1.2, and you got to 30,000 cases in West Africa. Exponential growth is a mighty thing. So my expectation is that this flattens. There are likely to be some, you know, some scary moments, some missteps. Oops, we have a hospital outbreak somewhere. But I think on the pattern of MERS and on the pattern of SARS, this probably stutters along through the spring and then sort of becomes an unpleasant memory. would be my bet, which is obviously fraught to say that, but I'm
sure,
but putting my nickel down.
How much of what happens next to that rate that you mentioned of how it spreads, how much of that depends on how nasty the virus is and how much of it depends on the stuff you talked about, like the lessons we learned from SARS and MERS?
We have a few different words in communicable diseases that subsume the broad construct of nastiness. One is what's called pathogenicity. That's how likely are you to get sick if you're infected, like sick being anything from sniffles to on a ventilator near death. Virulence is, do you get really sick? Does it have a high case fatality rate? Right now, we have a denominator of 250 cases and a numerator for case fatality of, I think, right now we're in the low digit percents, but that will climb. So that's virulence. And then we have infectivity, you know, which is really this reproduction number thing. You know, how many secondary cases are we going to get per primary case? And again, I'm actually don't feel like this is going out on too much of a limb based on that first case cluster where you know you have 40 cases and then you've got one secondary case. That sounds an awful lot like MERS, where out in the community, this doesn't move around, and then in hospitals, we know it does.
So what would you recommend just to the average person who is like, oh my gosh, can I go out in a crowded subway? Can I fly on my flight next month, which incidentally is me, but also, you know, people who are planning stuff?
You sure can. I mean, it's interesting because I came here on the subway and the masks have appeared.
Yeah.
So people are wearing surgical masks already. I mean, it's fascinating. Like the like how hardwired this is. It would be interesting to know. I mean, I remember during SARS, Jean Chrétien making a point of eating in Chinatown. As I say, you know, there are a lot of communicable disease hazards in the wide world. If you're concerned, I mean, a couple of the local hospitals have travel medicine clinics. You could get some knowledgeable advice there. At the moment, I mean, I think you can pretty much rest assured that given the emotional temperature around this issue, advisories are going to probably get issued with high sensitivity and low specificity. So, you know, given that, if there's no advisories at all, you're fine. And I've given the same advice to colleagues over the past week who have, you know, Korea travel planned or what have you, where they have an imported case. It's like, you know, honestly, the world is a large place. And this is a teeny weeny infectious disease issue as of looks at watch the 22nd. And I think it's fine to travel wherever you feel like traveling to.
Based on California, now I feel a lot better about
it. Do it. Yeah.
Thanks, David.
Thank you so much for having me.
Dr. David Fisman, an epidemiologist from the U of T, and very reassuring today. That was The Big Story. If you would like more, find us at the website, thebigstorypodcast.ca. Find us on Twitter, @TheBigStoryFPN. Find us in your podcast player, whichever one you like. Apple or Google or Stitcher or Spotify, we prefer you use the ones that let you review us. And when you do, we would prefer 5 stars, if you're kind. Thanks for listening. I'm Jordan Heath Rawlings. We'll talk tomorrow.
Hi there, I'm Gavin Crawford. I'm a writer, an actor, and a comedian. And for the last 8 or 9 years, I have been navigating life with my mother's increasing dementia. Has it been sad? Yeah. Has it been funny? Also, yeah. That's what my brand new podcast series, Let's Not Be Kidding, is about. It's the true story of my life as a comedian, my mom, and dementia. Let's Not Be Kidding, with me, Gavin Crawford. A new 7-part series from CBC Podcasts, available now.